the History with Jackson podcast.
Hello and welcome to the History of Jackson podcast, the podcast where we bring up-to-date historical research to you in an accessible and digestible way. Hello, and today we welcome back Nicholas Morton to talk all about his brand new book, The Crusader States, Their Neighbours and Military History, 1099 to 1187. Now, I have my copy right here. I absolutely love reading this. I got through it like a breeze. I haven't put it down. So how are you doing, Nick?
Great, thanks. Yeah, and thanks for having me back on the show.
No, it's all right. Any opportunity to talk about the Crusades, I will happily jump on it. So I'm very excited to talk about them with you today.
Excellent.
So you probably know this first question. You've been on the show before, but I want to ask you, you know, what was your inspiration behind writing this book?
Okay, so when I first started out studying the medieval Middle East, one of the big questions for me was, what was the nature of the relationship between the major religions in the area? Because, of course, the thing that you are told immediately about the Crusades is that this is a period where you could effectively draw a line down the middle of a map, right? Christian territory on one side, Muslim territory on the other side, and the two just fight each other. And what fascinated me is, as I read primary sources, whether that's primary sources by Muslim authors or Eastern Christian authors or Byzantine authors or Western Christian authors or Jewish authors, this is not the picture that I received. It was something very different. It was something much more complicated. Yes, there was an underlying conflict, but there's a lot of other things going on as well. And I was thinking about, well, how do I research that in a way that really sort of draws that out from the sources? And so I settled on military history. And the thinking was, if I created a database containing every single military encounter I can find being fought anywhere in the Middle East, and I found several thousand of them, then I can begin to work out who's fighting who and when the battle lines shift, and how frequently it is simply a case of Christians fighting Muslims, or, as I found, it's very often a case of one Christian and Muslim allied army fighting another Christian and Muslim allied army, or Christians fighting Christians, or Muslims fighting Muslims. It's so much more complicated. And so really the thought behind the book was to try and show statistically just how complex the networks of wars and alliances and treaties and friendships and all the rest of it that goes on in the East, how complex that was. And so that was the underlying thought. And then it sort of grew out from that point, really, and took in other things like the layout of castles. And I'm also interested in technology and how technology and technological ideas change hands and cross cultural borders. That's something else that I was interested in. But if you'll forgive me a slight digression, the thing that triggered me on this is there's a wonderful book written in the 12th century by someone called Usama ibn Munkid, which is available actually in a very good translation via Penguin Books. And the story that got me really thinking concerned an event that took place in 1111. And in this year, an army from the Principality of Antioch, that's one of the territories established by the First Crusade, besieged the town of Shaizar, which was ruled by a dynasty called the Banu Munkid, an Arab dynasty. And the siege went very badly for the Crusaders, very well for the Munkids. And so after an attempt to try and take the town, the Crusaders, or Franks as they were known, staged a nighttime retreat. They did a lot of fighting at night because it threw off their opponent's archery. Most of the other societies in the Middle East depend very heavily on mounted archers, so fighting at night makes sense for the Crusaders. So they're conducting their nighttime retreat, and the Munkids chase them and pursue them in the hope of turning their retreat into a rout. And this continues until a Frankish knight stands out from the ranks of his retreating fellows and holds off the Munkids to enable the escape of the Frankish army, and he himself escapes soon afterwards. Now, what's interesting is none of that. What's interesting is what happens next. And that is that this knight goes to Shaizar when he's recovered from his wounds and effectively knocks on the gates and says, look, I really admired the way that your warriors fought in that battle the other day. can I come in and we'll train together for a few days? And the Munkid say, yes, of course. And so in he goes, clearly having expected his former enemy's hospitality and then receiving his former enemy's hospitality. They train together. Doubtlessly they ate and exchanged stories together. And then he went home. And I, just reading that story, I thought, this is not what I've been told. This is not the sort of diametrically opposed, hatred-driven conflict that you typically get told about. So that's the starting point, really, for then the thinking that then ultimately became the book.
I love that there's so many different stories within that story to get to this book. But also, I love how it wasn't actually that main moment there of him turning around that wasn't the interesting part for you. So you definitely made me laugh on that. But there was a couple of different threads in that answer there that I kind of want to unpick, really.
Sure.
Specifically, the database point on that as well. I think everyone has this idea of us as historians that we sit there, we read things, and then we write. We don't really do anything else aside from that. Maybe we drink a lot of coffee. But, you know, how as a historian, creating a database and making a database, how is that process helpful? And how do you go about doing that as well?
So it started off about years ago. I just realized, just for general reference, it would be a good idea to create a really detailed timeline of everything going on in and around the sort of western part of the Middle East, which is the part I'm most concerned with. And I just thought, as a reference tool for me, just having that timeline, which by now is almost sort of day by day, that would be really useful. So I started making this timeline. And then as I made it, I began to realize, actually, I'm sitting on something more important here, that the more comprehensive this becomes, the more I can actually then draw out of it statistical data, statistical findings that are actually very meaningful. And so I went back and I revised the timeline to put in various fields that would help me to do that. Is this a Kingdom of Jerusalem offensive? Is this a Fatimid Empire offensive? Who won the resulting encounter? What type of encounter is it? Is it, and the categories I used is it a naval encounter? Is it a raid? Is it a skirmish? Is it a battle? Is it a siege? Is it a rebellion? Those are the categories I used. And then obviously plus references. And so I created various fields so it could be searched in various ways. And then I went through every single source I could lay my hands on to try and make it as comprehensive as possible. And to be fair, I have found about three or four, admittedly fairly small military encounters since the release of the book. So it needs a bit of updating now. But I did find several thousand. Now, I don't claim to have found everything. Some regions are much better served by the sources than others. So southern Anatolia, you can do as well as you can, but there's still a lot there we don't know. Whereas the further south you get, sort of Egypt and areas around Egypt, around there, that's much better served. You can be reasonably sure you've got pretty much everything. So it varies on region, it varies on culture as well. So some cultures are very well served with sources, others less so. So it's not perfect. I can't guarantee I've got every battle or encounter that was ever fought, but we can do as well as is plausible. And I felt that if I created this database and was comprehensive as possible, whilst acknowledging the fact that we are limited by what survives in the sources, that we can draw out statistical information. And that includes how frequently different societies fight against each other. That includes how frequently individual rulers, whether that's Tughtekin, Emir of Damascus, or King Leon of Armenia, or Emperor Manuel Comnenus of Byzantium, how frequently they fight and with whom, where they're building castles. It just helps you to graph these things out. Who's winning battles, in which periods and when are they losing them as well? And so you can graph out incursions, you can graph out victory and defeat. And what I was interested in was the military dimensions. I was taken around enough castles as a child to want to have an interest in military history for itself. But that's not the extent of my interest. What I was also really interested in is what military history can tell us about everything else. And the reason for that is quite simple, that the medieval sources, they talk primarily about three things. They talk about religion a lot. They talk about dynastic politics a lot. And they talk about war. And if you take those three things out of most medieval chronicles, almost irrespective of which culture you're talking about, you wouldn't be left with very much. And there is, forgive me for saying this, but there is among some historians a sense that military history is somehow less rigorous, less significant than other forms of history. And I felt very strongly this wasn't the case. And I felt that that sense was rather causing that military source material to not receive the attention it deserved. So I wanted to look at the military material not solely for military reasons, but to see what I could learn, particularly by putting it all together, what I could learn about economics. And you can learn a lot about economics because armies are the number one expenditure item for every single medieval state in the Middle East, bar none. And you can learn a lot about the individual rulers once you look at their campaigning record and look at who they're doing diplomacy with and who they're not. You can learn an awful lot about interfaith relations, which of course is my jumping off point. And so that was the thinking behind the book. Military history, yes, but also military history as a keyhole to everything else.
I really like how that database has started off as a timeline to then be in this network of events of which you can jump off and look at so many different areas of history. And I do totally agree with you. Military history is an incredibly rigorous discipline because you have to look at so many different things to fully understand the whole picture. But then within there, you were also talking about categories. Now, your categories, skirmishes, naval, sieges, battles, raids, rebellions, incursions. But also within your book, you also talk about the idea of success. Now, of course, we love context here at History of Jackson. And could you just give us some short definitions to build some context around these terms? Because they're, if on the surface, if you look at a skirmish or a raid, some people might, well, what's the difference between a skirmish and a raid?
Yes, absolutely. And this was one of my biggest concerns. This was one of the things I spent a long time thinking over before I created the database, before I started the book. And that is, how do you draw hard lines between categories? And you have to. You can't get round it. If you want to have fields that have drop-down menus where you click on one button or another, it has to be hard categories. But often there's a degree of fuzziness between those different categories, which you lose, and that's a shame. In practice, it wasn't nearly as difficult as I feared. The definitions I went for, which I hope are reasonably intuitive, and I wanted to go for definitions that would sort of automatically feel commonsensical. They would feel reasonable and the kinds of things that you'd expect. So for an incursion is considered to be any attack, any military campaign staged into someone's territory who is not your own, irrespective of the size of that incursion. So incursion was kept fairly broad as a category. And then you've got the military, the categories of the individual encounters. So a raid would be, I think it's something like an incursion into an opponent's territory, which results in damage to property or the pillaging of property, but doesn't necessarily include a military encounter with a substantial force. A siege would be a conflict fought between two forces with at least one of those forces lodged behind permanent passive defences. A skirmish, I think it was something like, I'm going to get the numbers wrong, but it's something on this margin, an encounter that either is known to have taken place with, I think it's something like between 200 and 2,000 combatants on both sides, or is likely to have, or given the context, is likely to have encountered those kinds of numbers. And a battle would be, a battle slightly more complicated, a battle would be an encounter that was larger than a skirmish, so you're talking about mid-thousands for both sides, but also it has to be a significant enough encounter to warrant attention from the authors of at least two different cultures. So I add a sort of impact clause there. It has to be something that more than one culture notices. Now that's not as precise as it is in the book, but it's that those are the kinds of encounters. A naval encounter is basically anything involving two ships from or more from different cultures. But crudely speaking, those are the categories I used for that particular field.
And those distinctions are really helpful going through the book because they help you understand what you're learning about and reading about. But now we're going to have to switch to these crusaders. These remarkably brave people have gone over to the Holy Land to on their crusading expeditions. But what's the context of the situation in the Holy Land when they arrive?
It changes. In the First Crusade, obviously they're setting out for the Middle East with nowhere to go, in a sense, in that there's no friendly territory for them in the coastal regions of the Middle East. They're going to carve out territories for themselves, and they do. But for later expeditions, whether that's the big crusades like the Second Crusade, for example, or the smaller expeditions, and there's lots of smaller expeditions. There's small crusades in 1110 led by King Sigurd of Norway. There's a Venetian crusade in 1123 to 24. There's another large-ish campaign in 1129, among others. So there's all sorts of crusading contingents arriving, not just the big numbered crusades, but it's one of the big challenges facing inbound crusade commanders that they arrive in the crusader states. And then there is the question of how they're going to be employed so as to prosper the crusader states, depending on what the crusader states rulers want to achieve. But that's more easily said than done, because often these crusade commanders arrive and they've been born and raised through their childhood with stories of the First Crusade. And these stories often describe heroic exploits. And there's obviously a few dragons in there because, well, why wouldn't there be? And there's princesses requiring rescuing and all the sort of the standard fare of sort of knightly heroic stories of that age. Problem is that now they're trying to live the dream. They've arrived in the Crusader States. They want that. They want that fantasy battle. And what they get instead is the local Franks in the Crusader States. And by Franks, this is a term basically meaning Western Europeans in the Middle East. The local Franks are much, much more pragmatic and level-headed. They don't want to launch some enormous campaign because that makes no sense for them in and amongst a complex network of alliances and treaties that they've got operating. Often their targets, their goals are much more niche, they're much more focused, they're much more to do with the realities on the ground, which isn't necessarily what an inbound crusader commander wants, who is thinking about epic clashes in hand-to-hand combat and all the things that he can then take home and boast to his family about. So there is often a disjuncture between the incoming crusaders and the local Franks, who have very different ideas about how wars can be fought and what their targets should be. And that causes all manner of disputes as both sides try to get their way. And even if they do settle on a military target, you've then got the problem that you've got all these crusader knights who want to conduct all these heroic acts, or as they see it anyway, and this isn't how war is fought. The people who are experts in how the war is fought in the Middle East are in the Middle East. The Templars in particular are often given the task of trying to sort of persuade incoming crusaders, no, we have to fight in strictly disciplined units. This has to take place. You can't just charge whenever you want and then try and win a reputation. You've got to stay put the whole time, sometimes for days, and just endure the fact that you're being attacked. You have to do exactly what you're told, and you only move when we tell you to move. Of course, this isn't what incoming knights want to hear at all. They want some magnificent cavalry charge. And of course, the crusaders' opponents, whoever those opponents, know this very well. And so they will presumably think, well, we know the crusaders will typically want to do this, so we'll try and provoke them. And so there is this secondary question of, well, once the crusaders have arrived, are they sufficiently level-headed to realise that they actually have to start learning quickly? Otherwise, they're going to be taken apart very, very swiftly.
So is this where the Crusader States experts have this aversion to open pitched battles with their enemies.
Yeah, pitched battles are not really what the Crusader States want. So in their history, the Crusader States rose in the first couple of decades after the First Crusade, so from about 1099 through to the 1120s. There's then a sort of stable period from the 1120s, 1130s onwards to about the 1180s. There's a lot of war being fought along the borders of the Crusader States, but they're broadly stable in that era. And then things begin to dip in the 1180s until the ultimate collapse following Saladin's victory at the Battle of Hattin. And in that period, yes, they don't typically like fighting battles. And there's very good reasons for this. They much prefer to achieve territorial advances by treaty or by sudden attacks because battle doesn't serve their interests. Now, the Crusader States can raise big armies if they want to, and their biggest could get to about 20,000 troops, which, given that in Western Europe, even sort of German imperial or French royal armies rarely got bigger than about 10,000 to 15,000 troops, that gives you an idea of the scale of the war making in the area. And they can do that. They can raise an army of that size. The problem is they've got no second army. If that army gets annihilated, their population base is too narrow to then rustle up a new army quickly to then plug the hole in the frontier created by their defeat. And besides, the Crusader States, their income comes from big coastal cities. They haven't got the depth of territory that you might have with somewhere like France or Germany to absorb territorial losses and then come back. They're within a few days. The Crusader States are only a couple of days' march from their western borders to their eastern borders. So defeat is problematic. And they know this. They know that if they're defeated really badly, that could be existential. That could be the end. And if, in 1187, it very nearly is. But they also know that if they're victorious, that doesn't actually bring them particularly much benefit, because crusading armies are slow moving. Most of their soldiers are on foot. They can conduct a little bit of raiding or maybe take a single strong point if they are successful. But that's about it. And now it's important to spin things round to their opponents. Now, as I've mentioned already, there are battles fought in various configurations. But the type of soldier that the Crusader States most commonly faces is Turkish-like cavalry. And their situation is very different. They're fast moving, nearly all are mounted. And so if they win a battle against the Franks, they can cover a much, much wider territory because they move so quickly. And they can conquer multiple strong points. They can raid extensive areas of territory. And of course, if they're defeated, because they're all mounted, they can just scatter. And so rather than all the Crusader States infantry all being wiped out following a defeat, if an army composed largely of Turkish-like cavalry is defeated, it just disappears and they just gallop as fast as possible away from it, and most will survive. So it's an asymmetric playing field. Crusader States lose a battle, that is a very big problem. If an army of Turkish-like cavalry is defeated, actually, it's not the end of the world. Most of them will survive. And that, again, it incentivizes the rulers of the Crusader States not to fight battles if they can possibly avoid it. The catch to this is they actually have to fight battles all the time, even if they don't want to. And the reason for that is that because they do face many invasions, they can't just retreat and wait for the invaders to go away because they haven't got the depth of territory to do that. So all they can do is to muster their armies around a frontier castle, and in doing so, offer the strongest possible deterrent for whoever's invading their territory. But if that invader is still willing to give battle, even though they have entrenched themselves outside a castle, they're going to have to fight whether they want to or not, and that frequently happens. And so it's an odd situation whereby the Crusader States don't like fighting battles. They much prefer other forms of military activity, but they still have to fight quite a lot of them all the time.
It's interesting how you're mentioning, not only is it the technological differences within the military that push them to have to get involved in these, but not want to get involved in these battles, but also the development of the Frankish territories and the Crusader States making it difficult for them to have to get involved in war and conflict. But then how do you've already mentioned, you know, we have these networks of alliances across the Holy Land, across the Middle East. How do these new Crusader states fit into that existing network of alliances?
During the advance of the First Crusade, the Crusaders become very, very aware very quickly that they're entering a complex political environment. And so basically, there are two major players in the Middle East before the First Crusade. One of them is the Fatimid Empire of Egypt. And the Fatimid Empire is a Shia, as opposed to Sunni, Muslim caliphate, and it controls much of Egypt and the Syrian coastline. On the other side of the border, so inland from that coastline, you have the Seljuk Empire. And the Seljuk Turks, advanced out of Central Asia at the start of the 11th century and conquered Persia, Iraq, Syria, much of Anatolia, that's modern-day Turkey, and created this enormous empire. And they only reached Syria about 20 years before the First Crusade, so they're new. And so what you've got is you've got this incoming, rapidly growing Seljuk Empire, and then you've got the Fatimid Empire, and they're locked in conflict. And so cities like Jerusalem are actually on the front line of that conflict and have been for decades before the First Crusade arrives. So when the Crusaders arrive, they are basically entering into a war zone. Seljuk Turks in Syria and then all the way out eastwards. And then you have Fatimid Empire in Egypt and the coastlands of Syria. And so they have to accommodate themselves to this environment. And they start off by seeking to make treaties with the Fatimids in Egypt. And right until the end of the Crusade, the last few months of the Crusade, there is ongoing diplomatic negotiations between the Fatimids in Egypt and the advancing Crusaders. They want to work together because they see a common opponent in the Seljuk Turks. And this comes to a sort of climax at the town of Arqa in today's of northern Lebanon today, where basically they try and hammer out a deal. And the Crusaders say, look, we will help you to conquer every single town or city the Seljuks have ever taken from you, if in return you give us Jerusalem in perpetuity. The Fatimids, by contrast, they say, we will allow you to visit Jerusalem. You can go there. You can pray at the holy places, but then you must go home. We won't give it to you in perpetuity. So both factions are trying to find a compromise, but it doesn't work. Negotiations break down, and the Crusaders then go on to attack and seize Jerusalem itself. But it's interesting to see how hard they work to make that deal operate. And by contrast, the First Crusade fights vigorously against the Seljuk Turks, who themselves vigorously try and resist the First Crusaders. So those are the two big building blocks, but it's actually more complicated than that because there are plenty of other protagonists in the Middle East too, because when the Seljuk Turks conquered the entire region, they displaced many Arab rulers. Before this, it had been Arab dynasties that had ruled the big cities, at least those that weren't in the Fatimid Empire, and the Seljuks overthrew all those dynasties. And many of those dynasties and the communities around them, they're still there under Seljuk rule, and they don't want to be under Seljuk rule. And so in the years, both during the First Crusade and immediately afterwards, you actually have a series of Arab rebellions against the Seljuks, or indeed you have alliances between Arab dynasties and the Franks against the Seljuks because they see a common enemy. I've often wondered if the alliance formed, or the many alliances formed between different Bedouin communities and the Franks, again, at an early stage, I've wondered if that is also because the Seljuk Turks, who were a nomadic people, had forced them off their grazing grounds. So it is complicated. There's various different factors at play. There's also a large Eastern Christian community, particularly in the north. And the Armenian Christians also rebel assertively against the Turks during the First Crusade and afterwards. And later on, they have a fairly uneasy relationship with the Franks, but they do often work together as well. So again, this breaks down any simplistic notion of Christian territory and Muslim territory. There are lots of agendas at work. The causes of war are in part religious antagonism, but it's also about population movements and conquests and dynastic disputes and trade disputes and just the sort of the cut and thrust of the evolving alliances and treaties, really. And it's a lot more complicated.
It really tackles those misconceptions of the Crusades as being a Christian versus Muslim conflict, and that's it. And it's by addressing those misconceptions, I think it brings more depth and breadth to the subject than what is traditionally thought of, as I've just said, and then maybe just throw the Templars in there for good measure as well. But within the history of the Crusades, and you've previously spoke about several big empires, there's also a key figure on the non-crusading side who probably dominates the narrative at a certain point. I think it'd be unfair to not talk about him. So it's Saladin. So yeah. Who was Saladin, and why is he such a big problem and a big figure in crusading history?
Okay, so bit of background. Over time, in the wake of the First Crusade and the expansion of the Crusader states in their early decades, there is a Turkish leader called Zengi who plays a crucial role in preventing the further expansion of the Crusader states. To be fair, he's not actually that interested in the Crusader states. He's much more interested in waging war on other frontiers. And it has to be said, there's a lot of other wars going on in the Middle East in this era. It's tempting to think that the Crusades are the biggest show in town because that's what everyone keeps talking about. Actually, there are lots of other things going on as well. And he's interested in other conflicts. But the sheer size of his growing empire means the Crusader states aren't going to expand any further. And then his son, Nur al-Din, he takes over the western portion of Zengi's empire following Zengi's death in 1146. And again, Nur al-Din fights against a range of opponents, but also the Crusader states. And what really sort of brings Saladin's career into the spotlight is in the 1160s, it becomes increasingly clear that Fatimid Egypt, so the Shia Muslim caliphate I mentioned previously, has become embroiled in civil war. And the various protagonists in that civil war, they reach out for help to Nur al-Din and also to the Kingdom of Jerusalem, which is the largest of the Crusader states. And those requests for help then draw in Nur al-Din's armies and the armies of the Kingdom of Jerusalem. And so you have a remarkable three-way contest between various Fatimid factions, Nur al-Din's army, and the Kingdom of Jerusalem's army. And Saladin is the second in command of Nur al-Din's sort of field army that he sends into the region. The main commander is Saladin's uncle called Shirka. And in 1168, Shirka does eventually succeed in securing control over Egypt in its entirety. And he dies soon after taking power. And Saladin then becomes Nur al-Din's lieutenant in Egypt. So Saladin's still operating within the broader umbrella of Nur al-Din's empire. And yet, as the years go by, Nur al-Din starts to become more and more concerned about Saladin, because whenever he tries to instruct Saladin to conduct a military campaign, Saladin sort of shows willing and then pulls back. And Nur al-Din begins to fear that actually Saladin's trying to go independent. He wants to create Egypt as his own power base and is no longer responding as he should to Nur al-Din's instructions. And in fact, Nur al-Din dies in 1174. Still, and at this point, he's become so concerned about Saladin, he's actually putting together a military force to go into Egypt and force Saladin to submit to his authority, but he dies before that happens. Then, after 1174, Saladin spends the next decade and a bit. He advances with his forces out of Egypt and then begins to conquer his former master's territories. So he takes Damascus in 1174. Immediately after Nur al-Din's death, or very soon afterwards, He then advances north, taking the towns of Hama and Homs, and eventually he takes the city of Aleppo in 1183. And during these years, he is also fighting the Crusader states from time to time, but it's not his primary interest, and neither is he very successful. Now, Saladin conducts much of this campaigning on the promise that once he has established an empire big enough, he will turn that force on the Crusader states and win the reconquest of Jerusalem. But for decades, that doesn't happen. And so he's drawing very heavily on the language of jihad, but he's not actually come through with the outcome he's been promising. At the same time, he's been fighting war after war against his former master and his former master's descendants. So Saladin does build an empire, but it's a dangerous balancing act because people are saying, well, look, if you are going to conquer your former master's territories, you're going to have to make good on this promise that you are going to overturn the Crusader states at some point. And so this comes to a real climax in 1187 when Saladin does invade the kingdom of Jerusalem. I've often wondered if his invasion had in fact failed, whether that would have been it for him. That would have been the end. You know, he's had more than his fair share of chances to make good on this promise to overturn the Franks, but he hasn't done so. So he's under tremendous pressure. But fortunately for Saladin, he does win a major victory over the Crusader states, over the kingdom of Jerusalem, which then realizes the sort of Achilles heel of the Crusader states, which is that they can raise big armies, but they can't raise second armies. So if they lose their main army in its entirety, there's no second line of defense. And so after this victory for Saladin at Hattin, he is then able to advance and conquer the overwhelming majority of the kingdom of Jerusalem. Jerusalem itself falls a few months later. And he also sends columns north to attack the northern Crusader states. So this is a disaster for the Crusader states, but for Saladin, this is the victory that he has always promised he'll deliver.
And that really, as you've done throughout this conversation, it really addresses some misconceptions that we have about Saladin, how he's this big, successful ruler, and that his conflict with the Crusader states was inevitable. But actually, you've painted him as a man who is under pressure, who crucially needs this victory at Hattin to realise that promise and to ensure his own survival.
He's got enormous amounts of ability. His primary strength is in diplomacy. He's also a very effective field commander as well. So he is very much, he's a very, very high ability individual. But it has to be said that something that I am determined to do in all my research, which is to avoid any sort of trying to... I'm always suspicious of historians who write up heroes and villains, whoever those heroes and villains are. I'm not interested in heroes and villains. I don't think I've met many in my actual life. I think heroes and villains have much more to do with writers writing later, constructing them as such. What I'm interested in is human beings. And human beings, as you say, they have pressures on them. They have concerns. They have strengths. They have weaknesses. Some are high ability, some aren't. But human beings, they remain. And so for me, at least, I always grow suspicious when I'm reading medieval sources if I feel somehow I've lost touch with the human beings being described. If people become too tyrannically evil or too nobly good according to the standards of their day, I become suspicious because I'm interested in humans. That's what I'm here for.
And I really like how you're getting away from that great man narrative that we're trying to get away from at the moment in history, which is really nice. Now, I have a final fun question.
Okay.
As we do for all guests here, and you've already had one, so this is your second. Now, you've worked on several book series, which I find absolutely fascinating. What's your favourite part of working with a variety of historians in your field to create a work?
Sure. So, yeah, I edit three book series for Routledge, and they are Rulers of the Latin East, which is a collection of biographies of the leading families or queens or kings or patriarchs or leading figures of the Crusader states. I have another series called The Military Religious Orders, which is about the Templars and Hospitallers, and so books on that subject. And also another series called Global Histories Before Globalization, which is looking at global history, basically, in this era. And I love editing these series for many reasons. I love working with my co-editors. So each of these series, I work with a colleague, and that's great. I like working with other people. But I think for me, the most rewarding part of this is being able to support and encourage new scholars, and particularly those who are writing their first book, who are unfamiliar with how the process all works, and just being able to be a support and a sort of a listening ear, or be able to offer some advice if it's asked for. The ability to do that and to show encouragement for people who are starting in on the career, that's really great. And, you know, it's, in a sense, it's trying to hand back what was given to me. There are many people who are so very kind to me when I started my career, who gave a great deal of time and energy to supporting and encouraging me. And so I want to do the same, really. I want to be there as a support for people who are starting in on this career and need some guidance and some support in the process of creating your first book, which can be quite a daunting process.
That's a really, really lovely answer. I really like that one. So thank you very much, Nick. Now, obviously, people have listened to us talk about the Crusader states and their neighbours, and military history, 1099 to 1187. And they're going to want to go away and grab a copy of the book, but also interact with you online and see your content online. So sure. How can they do that?
Yeah, absolutely. So you can follow me on Twitter. Just a simple search of my name should find me. Or I'm also on Instagram. I can't remember what my handle is for that. But I've also got a YouTube channel, and the handle there is @MedievalNearEast. If you're interested in buying the book, it can be purchased. I'm sure Amazon will supply you with a copy. And so the name is The Crusader States and Their Neighbors, A Military History, 1099 to 1187. But also, if you search for my name on Amazon, then you'll find my other books as well if you're interested. So those are the main points of contact.
Fantastic. And I'll make sure a link for all those in the description below, so people can go away and find you and grab a copy of your book. And also, I'll leave a link for our previous episode as well, because I think it ties really nicely with the discussions that we had today.
Perfect. Sounds great.
Well, thank you very much for coming on, Nick. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Now, thank you very much for listening to this newest episode of the History with Jackson podcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to Nick talk about the misconceptions that we might have about the Crusader states and the neighboring empires, and some of the key figures of the Crusades, such as Saladin. Now, if you enjoyed this episode or any of the other content that we create here at History with Jackson, please do consider heading to the Buy Me a Coffee profile in the description below, or subscribing to History with Jackson Plus on Apple Podcasts. It really does help us continue to create the content that we do on a daily basis. Now, I look forward to talking to you all yet again next week with another awesome episode with a fantastic historian.